So I'm afraid from now on it's in English. Just before I start the presentation, some of you I know are ex-accounting students and now working with Big Four firms or in banks. Some of you did very different things at LSE, and you may think, why would I be interested in the accounting and auditing profession? Well, I was just reading some statistics before I came about international professional service firms. And these are huge. PwC, the biggest of the Big Four, has 200,000 employees in 160 countries. So, as people say, it's more global than McDonald's. Its revenue in 2014 globally was $346 billion. That is bigger than some countries. It's bigger than Fortune 500 companies like Time Warner and 3M. So these are major, major economic entities about which people don't know all that much, because although they publish their accounts these days, they're not listed companies, so people aren't kind of interested in them in terms of affecting their own wealth. But they are behind the companies that are listed on the stock exchange. They provide the services which enable those companies to flourish. Obviously, international law firms, international engineering firms, there are plenty of advisory firms, but the accounting firms are the biggest of all. So it raises questions, and this is one of the themes I'll be talking about. What happens when these firms, which traditionally have been Anglo-American dominated, because historically that's where they started, and ever since America became the biggest country in the world, then economy in the world, then they kind of dominate the way in which the firms think and behave. Will that change when the biggest firm in their international network is Chinese? And that isn't very far away, the speed with which they're recruiting and growing in China. Most of them expect the biggest office in the world to be the Chinese offices. How will that change the dynamics of how these firms behave? They behave on the international stage, they influence governments, they influence the way standards are set, they're part of the kind of cartel of the World Bank and the big law firms and the big banks. How will it differ if their biggest firm is a Chinese firm? I don't know the answer, but clearly it's a question that could be very important in the future. So, as Brendan said, I'm doing the study with a colleague, Deng Xu Wen, who was a PhD student at Shanghai University of Finance and Economics, and is now working in the research department of the Shanghai Stock Exchange. And we were prompted, motivated to think about this when I heard a senior partner of PwC in Britain, when he was president of the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales, Peter Wyman, he said the next big five firm will be Chinese. And everybody went, oh, he must be joking. So we thought, well, you know, is he joking or is he serious? He said, I'm serious. So we thought, we can't tell whether the next big firm will be Chinese. What we can do is find out what informed people think about the way the profession is developing, both in China and worldwide, and how those two things will come together. So what we've done basically, obviously, is we've done the homework on finding out what's happened in the past and how we've got to where we are today, and how the industry structure in China has evolved. We've investigated the way in which Chinese firms are being supported and encouraged to grow and match the competence of the dominant Western firms. And then we can reflect on what appear to be the opportunities and the challenges that are faced by the Chinese firms, and then what that might imply for the change in the way that global professional firms are structured and operate. So, it's academic, which of these, I've got so many things to pray, here we are. So many things I could press. I think this is the one. Yeah. Obviously, we've done our homework by reading the literature, but the more interesting bit is that we carried out together, Dong Xiuwen and I carried out interviews together in London, in Hong Kong, and in mainland China with representatives of the audit firms, including the global chairman of one of the big four, with regulators in the countries, with investor representatives, and with academics. And academics are quite important in China, much more important than they are in Britain. I wish I was a Chinese academic, because people respect professors, they listen to what they say, whereas in Britain people just laugh at professors. Say, you know, obviously you can't do anything else. And so our interviewees included the big four audit firms, and perhaps more interestingly, the next tier. In Britain, the division between the four at the top and the rest is huge. But the next firms, I think the biggest one of the next 10 has about a quarter of the revenue of the smallest of the big four in Britain. But in China, it's not quite such a big disparity, and those firms, names like BDO, Grant Thornton, PKF, are the challengers now to the big four in China, as well as some independent Chinese firms like Pan China and Shine Wing. While we started the study in 2011, and then in 2012 there was quite a major shift in things, because the big four firms that had originally been allowed in under a special arrangement which was made to get round Chinese law, whereby they were had to form joint ventures with a Chinese audit firm. But whereas one partner might be KPMG with thousands of partners around the world, the Chinese audit firm in their joint venture might be one person, a professor from Renmin University who'd set up an audit firm, or somebody who worked for the Ministry of Finance and now set up an audit firm under their sponsorship. So it wasn't exactly an equal partnership. It was just a technicality to get around the Chinese law that said you can't have audits being done wholly by foreigners. But that 20-year arrangement fell in 2012, and the question then was, what will the Ministry of Finance do next about licensing the big four firms? They could have said, your foreign firms, go away. We've got plenty of Chinese firms now, but as we shall see, that wasn't really feasible at the time, and they have been renewed, as you know, those of you who worked for them, but under very strict new conditions, which I'll say something more about. So, we need to understand the history of how we got to where we are if we're going to think about where we might go next. Well, we can go back a long way. The first evidence of audit in China is the audit of the Emperor's administration, going back to the Western Zhou dynasty in 1100 BC. that was it in China, basically, for 3,000 years. Audit was a state activity, primarily concerned with making sure the emperor got his taxes and that his civil servants weren't squandering his money on illegal activities. But during the 1920s, when there was a kind of mini-capitalist boom in China, particularly in Shanghai, then firms, accounting firms, started up in Shanghai in particular, firms like Li Xin and Xu Lunfang. But of course, come the founding of the People's Republic, that all stopped, because again, all the property legally is state-owned again, and there's no role for private sector accounting and audit. So it wasn't until Deng Xiaoping started the reform and open policy that companies began to be formed again, private enterprise companies, and correspondingly the need for private sector auditors to monitor their behaviour. So there have been three stages really. First of all, when things restarted under the reform and open policy, then sort of nobody in China knew much about what to do about accounting and audit. So the big four firms were invited in to share their expertise, to run training courses, to support chairs in universities, to take people abroad to Britain and America, to help people learn how to be a private sector accountant and auditor. Then the next stage is to build the capacity locally to challenge foreign competitors. And the third stage, which is where we are now, is turning the foreign competitors into Chinese firms. And I'll explain a bit more what that means in a minute. Now, in fact, the firms themselves would say this is nothing peculiar to China. This is what's happened almost everywhere in the world where the firms have opened up in new countries. So normally there is at least something going on already in the other country that they can build on, whereas in China they have to start from scratch again. And they would say it's always our strategy that at the end of the day, the firm should become a local firm. So, for example, if you can imagine there was a time when I was young, after I just left university, then I joined, as Brendan said, I joined Pete Marwick, what is now KPMG. And while I was there in the late 1960s, my manager was sent to Paris to run the French firm of KPMG for 5 years. Now, if you go to Paris, all the partners in the French firm of KPMG will be French. So this is the firm's strategy around the world, to turn their firms into local firms. And they would say this is what they were expecting to do in China, but it was a bit more uphill because there's no tradition to build on, and they've only had about 20 years to build things up, and they would normally say, you know, to take somebody from scratch and turn them into somebody capable of running our firm in a country takes more than 20 years. But the Ministry of Finance has been pretty tough about this. And in 2012 they said, well, this is obviously the opportunity where we can do something to make this happen more quickly. So they've now imposed requirements about minimum numbers of Chinese partners who have the CICP exam. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. So what's happened since 2012 is that under the push of the Ministry of Finance and the CICPA, the firms have had to localise perhaps more quickly than they would have otherwise planned to do. It's not a complete change because most of the partners running the firms in China have been from Hong Kong. So they're in that bridge situation that Hong Kong occupies between the West and mainland China. So this is the timeline of the history, which tries to plot on the top what's been happening in China, and on the bottom what's been happening with the foreign firms. So the Chinese Institute of Certified Public Accountants was actually founded, the present one, in 1995, which is only 20 years ago. Whereas the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales was founded, I think, in 1865, which is 50 years ago. And similarly, the AICPA in America, a little bit later, about 1890. So you're matching somebody with 20 years' experience against somebody with 150 years' experience. So it's a challenge. And by 2000, so that's only 15 years ago, roughly, the firms were all completely disaffiliated from their government sponsors or their university sponsors and became independent accounting firms. The CICPA and the Ministry of Finance then encouraged the firms, some of whom were only one or two people, to merge in order to build up size and strength and efficiency and competence. And some of those mergers, this is what Bum Shu Wen was looking at for her PhD, some of them have been very successful, but a lot have been very unsuccessful, because basically they were forced marriages. Ministry of Finance would come along and say, you and you are now to be married as one firm. And like all arranged marriages, some are very successful, but some are disasters. And so, as you might have predicted, there were many forced marriages, but there were also many divorces pretty quickly. And that merger pushing, it took place more when the firms wanted to merge because they could see they needed to get bigger in order to be able to offer a range of competencies, get established name and brand and marketing and everything else. Then China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, which in principle means you have to open everything up to foreign competition. And there is a story that once China joined, the Americans said, oh, this means that we can compete freely in China in accounting and everything else. So will you please translate the CICPA exam into English, so that people from America can take it and qualify in China. And the Ministry of Finance replied with a straight face, gladly, as soon as you've translated the American AICPA exam into Chinese, since when nothing more has been heard from the Americans on that point. In 2009, the Ministry issued what is known as Document 56, which I'm going to talk about how they saw the structure of the profession in China. And in 2011, they issued 8-share licenses to, I think it was 12 firms, which would enable them to audit Chinese accounting firms, to audit shares listed on Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Now, even those of you who aren't accountants can see that 12 is bigger than 4. In other words, it wasn't just the big 4 firms, they were extending it to other firms to become auditors of listed companies in Hong Kong. On the side of the firms, they started appearing in about 1980. Initially very small, often they would, you know, they'd have a room in the Hilton Hotel and that would be their office as they tried to build things up. KPMG came in from the Hong Kong practice in 1981 and in 1992 those joint ventures were established for 20 years, which ran out in 2012. Meanwhile, from about 1995 onwards, the next tier of firms started to enter, like BDO and Grant Thornton and PKF. And they took in Chinese firms into their international networks. And then there's the localization in 2012, which I'll say a bit more about in a minute. But outside, in the world outside, firms have been changing as well. So maybe back in 1980, the audit firms were still primarily auditors who also did other services. These days, they are multi-discipline professional service firms who happen to do audits as well. And they use the audit, in a sense, as the way to get in and find out what other services they can sell to the clients. So their orientation is much more about providing paid services than providing a public duty of audit. And equally, it's been observed that in most countries, especially in Europe, America, Britain, the power of the professional institute has weakened considerably. You still have to have the qualification, probably, but they don't do much else, because all the accounting standards are set by the IAS, the International Accounting Standards Board. The profession is regulated by other government bodies, like the Financial Reporting Council in Britain, or the Public Companies Accounting Oversight Board in America. So they no longer regulate themselves. And so the power of the professional institutes in most countries has decreased. And the firms will say the biggest discipline is the marketplace. What guarantees that we will provide good service is that if we don't provide good service, the market will punish us and they won't hire us, so they'll hire somebody else. So that regulation is a bit unnecessary, they would argue, in that sense. Now, when you look at China, it's very different. The profession is dominated by the CITPA, and not only the qualification, but its rules and its inspections. And behind the CITPA is the Ministry of Finance. So in fact, if you go to the CITPA headquarters in Beijing, it's in the same building as the Ministry of Finance. And it's pretty clear which one is the boss. So in 2009, the Ministry of Finance issued their vision of what they thought was needed to build up the professional firms in China. They would deal with the structure of the audit market, with the service range that the firms would offer, and with the how to guarantee their professional competence to do that. So the audit market structure, they said, we want a structure of 10 super firms, again, bigger than four, and then 200 that deal with major companies but not international listings, and then another 7,000 that do smaller companies, specialist tax work and other things. So, if you ask the question, can a Chinese firm become the biggest firm, one of the biggest firms in the world, there are different ways of answering it. It is possible, and this is happening already, if you look at the market shares domestically of the firms, that just by doing domestic companies, domestic listings on Shanghai and Shenzhen, a firm can become the biggest accounting firm in the world, just because there are so many clients available in China. But that's not really what people mean by an international accounting firm. The next definition would be, well, the way in which the Big Four grew to where they are today was that originally the British profession was the dominant one, when Britain was the dominant economic power, and British companies were going overseas to Africa, India, wherever, And they would say, well, we want our audits done by our home auditors, so you'd better come too. So the accounting firms went as well to set up offices to service the overseas businesses. Initially of the British firms and then of the American firms as they went multinational. Now it is of course true now that Chinese firms are going multinational. I think was it 2 weeks ago a Chinese firm bought Hamley's famous toy store in London. So about the most British shop you could imagine is now owned by a Chinese firm. Most people in Britain don't even know this is happening, you know, unless they're following the stock market and things. They will go on assuming Hamleys is a traditional British firm. It's always been. Just like they assume Land Rovers are a traditional British car, whereas in fact they're built by Indians. Tata in India now own them. So all that is changing quite fast. And so again, a Chinese accounting firm might find itself around the world because its clients have gone around the world and want a Chinese auditor. But that's not an international accounting firm. An international accounting firm basically means one that audits companies that are listed on worldwide stock exchanges, normally cross-listed. So most of the biggest companies, as you know, in Britain are cross-listed in New York. A lot of them, the Hong Kong companies, will be cross-listed in London or New York. So as Chinese firms are beginning to get listed overseas, and that's been going on for some time because the biggest companies, the biggest state-owned enterprises like ICBC are listed in New York. And that was a deliberate policy of the Chinese government to try and shake them up by giving them a bit of market discipline to try and make them more competitive and profit-focused than they have been traditionally. So these firms are already cross-listed outside China, but their auditors are still either the big four firms outside China or the Hong Kong firm of the big four. They're not audited by the Chinese firm of the big four yet. So I have to say, a bit rude when you're speaking in China, but if you say to a British audience, the next big five firm is going to be Chinese, I mean, they laugh. It's a bit like saying, you're not going to want to buy a Land Rover anymore, you're going to want to buy a Great Wall SUV. I don't think, come on, we're joking. Well, the joke isn't actually a very good joke, because when I was a lad, I mean, as you realise it's a long time ago, you wouldn't touch a Japanese car. British best, we all knew that. But then people found out that Japanese cars were actually a lot better than British cars. And now they buy Japanese cars. Then we discovered that Korean cars were even better than Japanese cars. So now we drive Korean cars. Even Russian cars, Eastern European cars like Skodas, where the joke used to be the most expensive thing about buying a Skoda is filling the petrol tank. Now, my daughter drives a Skoda. It's hidden under a Volkswagen bonnet. But all the bits inside say Skoda on them. And as I say, probably only 5-10 years ago, if you said you'd like to drive a Russian car, people would have said that's ridiculous. So, at the moment, they're still saying, not very sure about Chinese cars, but apparently Great Wall is now selling cars in Britain. And hopes to sell cars in America, but it's quite tough to break the image. You know. It's particularly tough because a lot of Chinese still think it's better to have a Mercedes or a BMW or a Chevy rather than a Chinese branded car. You look cooler. But once that's broken, then, you know, and so the question is,
Is it true for things like professional services? It's much harder with professional services to know whether the product you're getting is better than somebody else's service. So the effect of branding is much more powerful in this area. So other things equal. Would you like to buy your audit from KPMG or from Shenzhen Crazy Shishu Swan? People will say, I think that's a no-brainer, I'd rather have KPMG. After all, who the hell are Shenzhen Crazy Shishu Swan? In fact, they're a very, very big firm, one of the biggest Chinese indigenous firms based in Hangzhou. But they do most of their work on Chinese companies and Chinese IPOs, Shanghai and around. They themselves don't seem to have many international ambitions. But these others are the ones that are Chinese member firms of what we call the second accounting and audit BDO. DC, which is a very famous corporate name for Canada. Dahua is a part of Moore Stevens Network, Grantham and Jatong. Shine Wing is the other one that people hold up as being the example of the most successful, completely independent Chinese firm that doesn't belong to one of the networks. Again, one of the things we've discovered doing this is it's not all that easy to decide whether a firm is Chinese or foreign. Shine Wing is run by a very dominant managing partner called Zhang Ke, and who's now very big in the CICPA, and widely known figure publicly. But in fact, Shine Wing was founded when Pricewaterhouse and Coopers and Lybrand merged, and he was in Coopers and didn't like the merger, so he took 20 or 30 people out of the firm to start an independent firm. But he's got Big Four blood in his veins as well, you see, so it's not quite so easy to say that a Chinese firm can start from nothing and become comparable to a Big Four. There they are, and as I say, any of those names would be meaningless probably in Europe or Britain or America, but they're going to have to get used to them, because these are the names of the firms that are going to be the biggest firms around in the future. So, that was audit market structure, where the ministry wanted to get a number of firms, including what they saw as Chinese firms, up into at least the top 10 to rival the Big Four. Now, to do that, they've got to be able to do, in a sense, what the Big Four do. And the Big Four don't just do audits anymore. One of the reasons that they say we don't want to just do audits anymore is we want to attract the best people to come into these firms. We want the LSE graduates to come to our firm. And other things equal, as the economists always say, if you offer a bright student, would you like to work for a firm where you're going to spend the next 40 years checking other people's accounts? Or would you like to work for a firm where you're going to be giving dynamic, cutting-edge entrepreneurial advice to firms on how to build a successful future? Most people, not all, but most people, especially probably LSE graduates, may well, I think I'd rather do the latter than I've learned so many interesting things, I'm a go-ahead sort of person, I know I'm very capable. So in order to get the best people into the Big Four firms, they say we need to do a range of business activities which will attract the best people to come work for us, and also enable us to do better audits because we understand more about the way the business operates. So the Ministry of Finance agrees and is encouraging the firms to build up their competency is there. Not easy, because apparently it's not a traditional Chinese thing to have that kind of advice. So it's a hard road to travel. And therefore they want to transform the firms and upgrade them into this. Now, if you talk about these other services in Europe, or in Britain, or in, well, I'm not going to say Europe or Britain, you have to say in continental Europe or Britain, or in America, then people say, yes, but we all know that the fact that the firms offer non-audit services impairs their independence for audit. In fact, the evidence is not particularly strong either way, but certainly that's the public perception. Because auditors offer other, more lucrative services to clients, they lose the ability to stand up to them and give adverse audits. So there's been a huge move, especially since Enron, to say that the firms can only offer very limited other services to their own clients. So what they've had to do is, they still offer the services, but now they offer them more to other companies. So in a sense, if you take the Big Four as a whole, nothing much has changed, because it used to be the PricewaterhouseCoopers did the non-audit services for the PricewaterhouseCoopers audit clients, and similarly for KPMG and Deloitte and Ernst & Young. Now what happens is that PricewaterhouseCoopers do the services for the KPMG audit clients, and KPMG do the services for the Deloitte audit client, and so around the circle. But within the circle of the Big Four, nothing much has changed. But the direct link to their own clients has been broken. So when you ask, as you did, when you ask the CICPA, well, you're busy encouraging them to do these other services, aren't you worried about the audit independence issue? They will say, oh yes, we've read all the debates in Europe and America about this. We'll worry about that when they can do them. The priority at the moment is to get them to have the skills to do these things, then we'll worry about the independence issue. So this is long-term strategy, as you might expect from some Chinese government ministries. The other thing is, obviously, there's no point in having these brilliant people in big firms doing all sorts of things if they don't actually know any accounting. So again, historically they had to start by getting the Big Four to come in and teach. Then China puts much more emphasis on the strategic role of its universities, and in particular in this area, on three huge accounting institutes you may know about. The Beijing National Accounting Institute, the Shanghai National Accounting Institute, and the Xiamen National Accounting Institute. And these are set up by Premier Zhong Ruihui, is it? Under the advice of Yu Kuan Yew of Singapore. He says, you know, what you need if you're going to have a market economy is accounting. And you better train them, and fast. You haven't got anybody at the moment. So they established these huge institutes that get through sort of 10,000 students a year each, of different levels. When I was speaking there, the one in Shanghai last week. And everybody says that the CICPA's exam is one of the toughest that there is. Now, because my Chinese is lucky, I wouldn't know whether the questions are difficult or whether they just don't pass many people. But that would be something I'd be interested to find out more about in the future. What is the difference between, say, the ICAW's exam in Britain and the ACCA exam and the Chinese CICPA exam? Almost every Chinese student we speak to who says they're doing the CICPA exam, I mean, this is a nightmare, and desperate hoping to pass. Everyone is always desperately hoping to pass the county exams, but this seems to be worse than any of the others. And it seems to be regarded internationally as high quality because it's recognised by other bodies. So my professional body, the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales, if you get the CICPA exam, then I think you only have to take two more papers now, and you can become an ICAW member. A big push on that. The other big thing that now makes Chinese accountants say, well, you're as good as anybody else, is that whereas accounting always used to be a kind of national thing, every country had its own rules, now it's international. Everybody, well, certainly in the European Union, every listed company has to follow international accounting standards. The Americans, of course, are different because they have to follow US GAAP, but for the last 20 years or so, they've been converging the actual content. So that the difference is not anything like as great as they used to be. And in China, there are international standards on auditing, ISO, which China now fully complies with. And there are international accounting standards or international financial reporting standards for accounting, which China nearly complies with. So the Chinese accounting standards, we still have to follow, are sort of 95% the same as the international standards. And the Chinese government has said the roadmap is there will be full conversion when we think our markets are mature enough to take all of the fair value items and impairment adjustments that are required under international standards, which are currently not allowed under Chinese standards. So the intention is that Chinese accounting by its companies and its auditors will be exactly the same as the rest of the world. So the Ministry of Finance and the CICPA are saying, look, we've got Chinese firms with well-qualified people, able to do a range of services. They need to be getting the work that the Big Four firms have. And the government also has another string with bow, though obviously the firms absolutely deny this. They allege that, you know, if you're in the office and you're American head office, you're going to be leaking Chinese industrial secrets to America. Now, to the auditors, I mean, they just can't believe this because they spend their whole life learning industrial secrets and never telling anybody about them. So they vehemently deny allegation, but the Ministry of Finance seems convinced that this is a leak and it should be stopped. So, where are we then? The Big Four joint venture licenses expired, but the Ministry couldn't say, okay, we don't need the Big Four firms anymore. There aren't yet enough competent leaders provide services for big companies. But the Chinese firms are getting bigger, merging and also acquiring consulting competence, and the biggest handicap is probably just this reputational legacy. You know, if you start from scratch only 20 years ago and you're up against people who've been doing this for 150 years or so, then it's very difficult to match the reputation, and also there is the perception, at least from outside of China, you never quite know how independent they are from the government, or whether the government is pulling the string. There was an announcement by the Ministry of Finance about 3 or 4 years ago, which said, you know, the government agencies cannot influence the audit opinion of the accounting firm. Fine. But why do they need to make the announcement? Presumably because government agencies were influencing the audit opinion of the accounting firm. Now, on the East Coast, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, people would say, you know, this isn't the world we live in now, everything's pretty transparent. But apparently, as you go further west, it could be the case that the provincial government anxious to show development achievements to the central government might be pressuring both its companies and their lawsuits to make the results look good. So provincial governors get rewarded by elevation to the central party committee if their provinces are economically successful. So there's problems with incentives there. But Chuan Wing, famously, about 2 or 3 years ago, said that they were auditing some local government security. Can you hear me all right at the back? Don't do that. And they said, these are not worth the paper they're printed on. That was pretty brave. That for the local government paper was worth it. And everybody was, first of all, shocked, but then, of course, impressed. The Chuan Wing is obviously a very independent-minded firm. It would be a clear, unbiased audit. When Xu Wen was looking at the effect of these mergers, then it did look as though quite a lot of them, perhaps the reason I said about forced marriages, had not been very happy the first few years. They were just getting bigger in order to be bigger rather than to be better. But more recently, there's a study by Professor Wu Lian Sheng and some others at Beidou and people in Hong Kong, which seems to show that the mergers are producing efficiency, which would consistent with economics that says, you know, there are economies of scale and economies of scope. The Americans are probably more suspicious about China than other countries, and that's reflected in the fact that their oversight board for auditors has been having standoffs with the Chinese professionals. They've been concerned about reverse takeovers, where a Chinese company buys a Shell-listed company in the US in order to get a listing. So recently Charles Lee, who's a professor at Stanford and at PKU, has done a study and he says there's no evidence that this population of firms is any worse than any other population of America. There's plenty of sub-firms in America, and they're not confined to the ones that are Chinese. Similarly, the regulator in America has been complaining that they are entitled to inspect all audit working papers of companies.
What is a reverse takeover before you continue?
Say again?
What is a reverse takeover?
A reverse takeover is where you have an active company in China and you want to get it. Now, if you apply to get this, you're going to have to go through procedures, auditing, bankers, very expensive business. So what you do is you find a company that used to be a big company in the US,
right,
still got its shares listed, and quite cheap, and become, let it become the legal holding company, with the new structure and practice that you're coming to. Doing everything and making it. But that's a reverse takeover. And the suspicions that there were Chinese companies that were a pretty dubious outfit were using this as a way of getting a listing without being investigated, as you were going to if you applied to one. But as I say, the evidence that Charles Lee has looked at is, well, yeah, there are Dutch firms on the New York Stock Exchange, but there are no more Dutch firms in this group. The thing about the inspections was particularly difficult because I think the PCAOB wanted to see the working papers of Deloitte for one of its Chinese clients, Chinese firms. And the ministry said, no way. It's against Chinese law to show anything to foreign companies. But standoff. And the Americans got very upset about it and threatened to revoke the license for the big four firms in America. So they wouldn't be able to do anything, anywhere. So it did get a bit tense for a while. And fast, not all these things. In the end, international diplomacy prevailed and it's come to a kind of agreement, which is that the Americans will trust the Chinese regulators of inspection, unless something goes wrong, if there is a scandal or a company goes bust, etc. Then they say we still preserve the right to come to find out whether the audit is worth it. And at the moment it hasn't come to that, so the Chinese company hasn't said no yet. So that's kind of cooled down. It was pretty nasty a couple of years ago, especially when the SEC was threatening to remove the licenses of all the big four firms in America. That would have shaken things up a bit. So the domestic firms, because of a shorter history, are not yet seen as mature in risk management. And one of the problems is that if you read all the literature about auditing in the West, one of the reasons that auditors are supposed to at least try to do a good job is that if they don't, they will have the pants moved off. So, a few years ago in Britain, and there was a case where they were sued for 250 million pounds for allegedly a bad audit. They settled out of court in the end, very unlikely to sort of survive. So they really are up against it. Every time they put their name on something, there's somebody out there waiting to sue you for having done a bad job. Now, Chinese firms don't face that at the moment. The level of legal liability in China, that kind of thing, is very, very low. What they're fighting of is the regulators, the Ministry of Finance, the PRCPA, the CSRC, who may either penalise them with fines or revoke their licence. So they're worried about that. But as long as they're happy they can show the tickle box for doing all this for regulators, then they're not so worried about the consequences that might be. Apparently, I haven't been had time to follow it up recently, but although all these licences were issued for doing Hong Kong first, several of the firms, they wanted to have the license because it made them look good, but they don't want to actually do the work, because then you're exposed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange to the potential shareholder action for millions of dollars. So that's going to take time, as it were, for people to get used to living in that world. As I mentioned, Shine Wing is perhaps the prime example of one that's held up as showing that the firms now believe quality is what they're selling. And in this regard, the fact that they can say that they are now following the international standards is a good badge that they look with as good as any other firm around the world follow exactly the same standards. But there's standards and standards. In fact, the Chinese, you're very good at standards. You probably invented them. The famous Emperor Qin Shi Huang, first Chinese emperor, the one who had the Bing Ma in Xi'an, he standardized everything. So he standardized the currency, standardized the weight, standardized the road width. All the roads have the ruts in exactly the same width, so the carriages are all exactly the same size and go down the roads. And he standardized one other thing that you use every day. What did the emperor?
Coins.
Yes, so obviously the denominations have changed, but having those kind of coins, yeah. Something you use even more than coins these days. Chinese characters, hanzi, were standardized by. You can read the documents that the emperor put out confused, because each island obviously something different, because they use the word differently. But you can read the character. They haven't changed. So, in fact, you're very good at setting standards. But these standards have come from a completely different culture. International accounting and auditing standards have come from the Western accounting culture. So it's quite hard, certainly initially, for the firms to understand. As the Secretary of the CPA said, when we first got the international standards, it was this, they'd come from heaven. We didn't know what they meant, what they were meant to do, and this has been explored by one of my colleagues in the case of Russia, when Russia ended the communist system and adopted Western practices, and what translation of international standards means is quite a complicated process. You can translate the words, but translating the way people actually behave and do things takes a lot longer. So, we're in a situation of opportunities and challenges. The government wants sufficient numbers of large firms to rival the big four. People generally agree the mergers would have made firms that are better at more efficient and handling the risks in the long run. But because of this perception that Chinese firms can't be as good, the practical solution has been that they join the international networks, the network. And the Ministry of Finance seems to be happy that if you join one of those networks, you're still a Chinese firm. You don't thereby become a foreign firm. So they allow the firms to stay independent, they get all the international standards, and the big four said, well, we're going to end up being Chinese, but the MOF says it's too slow, and in 2012 they now insisted that by 2017, which is now only 2 years away, a maximum of 20% of the partners can be non-Chinese CPAs, and the chairman must be. This is a problem where the firms have been run by Hong Kong partners, but the older Hong Kong partners are not so good in Mandarin, and they can't rely writing the character. They can't write the Chinese CPA standards. The younger ones can cope, but not the older ones. The pressure is on the big four because they're domestic share. More domestic firms are using the other firms. On the other hand, China is kind of coming back because it doesn't accept the international standards, like say Russia did, or other countries often have to do. They're now actually contributing to the development of those standards. So even though the CICPA is only 20 years old, there is a member of the ISB who is Chinese. Dr. Zhang Wei-Guo, who was Professor of Suki and then head of the Chinese Security Regulatory Commission, he's on the ISB, and they also influence the accounting auditing one. The government is trying to get the big SOEs to appoint non-big four. So, unfortunately, the CSRC doesn't agree with them. The CSRC still thinks that for the biggest ones, the banks and the insurance companies in New York as well, that to be credible as financial institutions, they've got to have big four auditors. So there is a division of opinion in the government about how to do it, because the CSRC reports to the Premier, has the status of a ministry. So for the moment, they're holding the line that there should be big four. So, China, just from sheer size, can change the world ranking in terms of who's the biggest, but whether Chinese firms can become truly international depends on a lot of these other factors, and also what people say a problem, that Chinese firms are run differently to partnerships elsewhere. Chinese firms are controlled, normally by a dominant managing partner. They like to have a dada who tells them what to do. and getting the Dadas to give up their power is going to require a major cultural shift. But if they're going to be running the worldwide firm, they've got to move in that direction. So, can the Anglo-American pattern still dominate when the Chinese is the So, I think change is certain. Everybody agrees that. It's going to happen. What they don't agree about is how long it will take. 5 years? 10 years? Maybe 20 years, but probably not much more. So there we are. That's it.